What's up, Stitches? Today we have this podcast's third interview. Woohoo! And we're getting into a form of needlework I haven't even touched yet. It's lace. Lace making, lace history, lace everything. Lace is something I've researched a bit, but really know very little about. So today I'm talking to Elena Kanagi-Laux, who is both a lace maker and a lace scholar, and my friend. Woohoo, friendship! Anyway, a lot of what I know and have seen about lace comes from Elena's fabulous Instagram page, which is at Erena Naomi. It's E-R-E-N-A-N-A-O-M-I. I will post it on all the So What social media. So Elena Kanagi-Laux is, in addition to being a lace maker and historian, the founder of the Brooklyn Lace Guild, which is devoted to the study and preservation of lace making. They have lots of meetings, classes, and other events, which you should absolutely attend if you're in New York City once life returns to normal-ish. In addition to being a lace queen, or as she says, lace princess, Elena is a collections specialist at the Antonio Ratti Textile Center at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. The Ratti Center houses almost all of the Met's textiles and is truly one of the greatest places on earth, in my opinion, but also in basically everybody's opinion. And the Ratti Center offers public research appointments if you need to see historic textiles for any research you're doing. It's also a reference library with a really banging collection. Do seriously check it out for yourself if you find yourself at the Met anytime soon. It is such a good time. Okay, back to Elena. She's also a huge fashion inspiration. She has a stunning collection of vintage and antique clothes she pairs with items she's designed herself. If you're even slightly into fashion, I'd really recommend checking her out. Between the lace, Met job, and amazing fashion sense, Elena is really out here living my dream. And I'm sure after listening to my interview with her, you'll all feel the same way. Here's the interview.
Thank you for being here today. I am very grateful and very excited. The first question I'm going to ask is, how did you get interested in historic textiles and costumes? And I know because I follow you on Instagram and I'll post your Instagram all over my social media, I know that your sense of style is really incredible and it utilizes a lot of vintage and antique pieces so beautifully. So I would love to hear about how you got into all of that stuff.
Well, first of all, thank you so much. You're too kind. I don't really have like a singular origin story. It's just sort of been congealing my lifetime, but I do like to go back to my heritage to sort of answer questions like that. My grandparents were Amish and Mennonite. Ooh, yeah. And in the 50s, my mom's parents moved to Japan as missionaries, and that's where she grew up. And so later on, I lived in Tokyo in the late 90s to the mid early 2000s. So I spent my childhood around Amish people sewing and embroidering and making everything by hand, and then was part of the like DIY fashion scene in Tokyo, where sort of anything goes was the vibe. And I had to learn how to make my own things because I couldn't afford the expensive things, and thrift stores were another resource. I could get a lot with $20 at a thrift store. I remember those days. Now you can't so much anymore, but you know, and then I could take it home and alter it and make it my own. And I guess the moment for me that was a really big game changer was going to middle school or junior high school in Tokyo and having to wear uniforms. And even in my uniform, I still totally stood out. Absolutely like a sore thumb. And so I sort of just gave up on feeling self-conscious at a certain point because I realized that no matter what I wore, I was going to get stared at, even in a school uniform, a local school uniform for public school. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, I'll wear whatever I want. Additionally, we went to school 6 days a week and we only had Sundays off. And that's how that fashion scene in Harajuku developed, was that kids could only dress as themselves for one day. So you really had to make it count. And then I just built from there. I worked in vintage stores, starting when I was like 17. And often they didn't pay well, but I would get either free clothes or clothing discounts.
Me too.
Yes. To supplement my income. So that has helped me to develop a big collection.
That is so cool. You are so cool. And I don't mean that in like a fangirly way, although I am a fangirl. You just your life is so eclectic, and you really, like, you can tell in your fashion sense all of those different origins, and they come together really beautifully. When you were starting to get into that stuff with vintage stores and thrift stores and, like, learning how to make, were there any specific time periods or, like, kinds of textiles or objects that really stood out to you that you were really interested in?
I've always been a big fan of, like, the very frilly Victorian aesthetic. I was also into Lolita fashion, obviously.
Yes.
And was really hyper femme in, like, high school and my late teens and stuff. And so it was very much inspired by the sort of Victorian baby doll aesthetic. So I was really into bloomers and petticoats and, like, Victorian lingerie, which used to be sort of dime a dozen in thrift and antique stores, at least where I lived, in Oregon, not in Japan, where Western vintage and thrifted clothes have always been astronomically expensive. Mm-hmm. But I was really drawn to the earliest stuff I could find, I think, just because it felt so of another world.
Yeah. The older something is, the more stories there are. That's what I always think. I think that's always why, like, at a vintage store or an antique store, I'm always drawn to the oldest thing there.
Absolutely. And for some people I know specifically, that the older clothing makes them uncomfortable because it is imbued with somebody's history, and that there's almost, like, this, like, ghost person attached to everything that you have. But I like to think that I'm surrounded by ghosts with my Victorian clothing and antique textile collection at home, mm-hmm. and that we're all friends. We all get along. We have a great community.
I really get that. I really enjoy, like, the weird stains that are left on clothes.
Absolutely. I also feel that way. It's so valuable and informative to us looking at textiles in, like, historic textiles in the Rati Textile Center in our collection. Like, those stains and impressions of the human body can tell us so much.
The human touch on textiles is so, it's really poignant, but it also is very informative.
It is informative. In fact, I'll jump ahead to a story that I love sharing that's lace related. In 2015, when I was doing lace research traveling around Europe on a grant, I made a stop in Florence at the Fondazione Lisio to take a sneaky velvet weaving class that wasn't related to lace, but also to do a lace identification workshop with Tessie Schoenholzer Nichols, who's an incredible lace historian and expert, who has since moved with her husband to St. Gallen, Switzerland, where she cataloged the, like, 30,000 pieces of lace collection at the museum there. It's incredible. But at the time, she was working at the Fondazione Lisio, and I took this lace identification workshop with her. You know, I really believed that I was so knowledgeable about lace already. And I was like, oh, I already know the difference between bobbin and needle lace, and I know all this stuff. Like, this will be great. But I'm really knowledgeable already. And I went in, and she just, like, blew me out of the water. First of all, like, at the end of the day, I was like, I'm a grain of sand in the ocean. I know nothing. And I still feel like that way. And it's good to feel that way, actually, because there is always more to learn. But more importantly, I remember she would point at a piece of lace at, like, a specific section or of a structural difference within the overall piece. And she would say, look at this. The lace tells a story. Look at where the lace maker was happy. Where were they sad? Like, what was going on? Tell me what they were feeling. And I was like, oh my God, this lady is crazy. But also, now I get it. Now I've been looking at lace for so long that I look at it and I've made it, and I feel it. I'm like, that sounds cuckoo bananas, I'm sure. And it's not academically valid. I'm not going to write that into a paper. But I also will say, I mean crazy in the most affectionate and positive, brilliant way possible in regards to Tessie, but it does tell a story. You can understand, wow, this is somewhere where they made a mistake and they got really frustrated and they, you know, chopped the threads off and they had to restart, or they, you know, this area is so brilliant and perfect. They were obviously, like, having a really good day that day. So, you know, although it's not, like I said, the foundation for real research, it does really make you feel connected to these things. And they really have more to them than this was in a catalog, this, you know, the provenance or the, you know, the depiction of them in artwork. Like, there's so much more to it that's more human with textiles. Yes. And that's why I love them.
Oh, wow. That was so beautifully eloquent, and everything that goes through my mind, like, all the time, and probably what goes through the mind of, like, a lot of people who are really interested in textiles and who listen to this podcast. So thank you for giving us all like a beautiful like Yelp review of how we feel, because that was brilliant. Okay, so you are the lace queen. So I want to know all about your history with lace. Tell me every, if you can, if that's not too much of an ask.
No, not at all. And I think I have to demote myself to like lace princess, because there are so many lace queens out there that I don't yet feel deserving of the title, but I'm working on it.
Inspiration.
But
yes.
But I, you know, it's hard to pinpoint when I fell in love with lace. A number of people I know have these wonderful stories where they went to Belgium and they saw a lace maker on the street and they were like, oh my God, I must learn how to do that. But it was really not something I knew anything about. But as a child, I learned to embroider and sew and quilt and knit and crochet from my mom and my grandma's and all this stuff that was important for a young woman to know. And I was really creative and interested in art and making my own clothes. But when I went to art school, I had such like an old fashioned or narrow perspective on what art was that I studied painting. Funny. I thought that was like art and that was what it was. You can study painting, right? But then when I was in school, I would go home and embroider and sew and do all this stuff. And I realized finally that our program also had fiber arts as an option for a major. And I was like, you can study that. So I switched immediately. And I basically got obsessed and did everything. I became a weaver and I learned to spin and I did every technique that I could possibly get my hands on, felting, dyeing, silk screening, everything. But over time I got interested in lace making. I'm not exactly sure what moment that was. I know I stumbled across a lace exhibition in Tokyo randomly when I was there, when I was like 17 or something. And that was really something I'd never thought about. Oh my gosh, how is this made, right? So I think after that, I kind of started to look around for an instructor. And it was just in the back of my mind as something I wanted to learn how to do, but it was elusive. So in like 2011, I was like Googling lace schools and I finally found one. There was nobody in New York City at the time. The closest teacher that I could find was in Ithaca, Holly Van Sciver, who's amazing, who I've since studied with, but I couldn't get all the way up there. It was too far. Right. But the first school that I came up upon that had a website, because this is 2011, a lot of lay schools didn't have websites, or at least not thorough English ones yet, was in Idrija in Slovenia. So I took myself there for their lace festival in June 2012, and I took one lace lesson. I went to the school and I basically like begged them for a class and they were like, oh, we only teach locals or we don't have like a format for like a private workshop because they only did like weekly classes. So I couldn't, it didn't quite work out, but I met people and they introduced me to other people and somebody said, I'll just teach you, you know, one-off class. So, and I just was obsessed. I did it and I immediately knew this is for me. I love doing this. And it took a long time before I could get really good at it or even good enough to follow a pattern or to do my own work without lots of help. But I just, the meditative practice, like, I just loved it so much.
I now want to go to Slovenia to learn how to do that. For people who are interested in learning how to make lace, what's the first step? How do you go about doing that?
That's a great question. Actually, there are lace makers everywhere, which is amazing, but they were hard to find for me. Like I said, 9 years ago, they are not a PR savvy or digital savvy people, although that's changing, which I love. But there really are lace makers all over the globe. If you're in the US, I would recommend that you check out the International Organization of Lace Inc., which is IOLI. They have a website and they have a map where they have regional guilds. Every regional guild that's chartered with IOLI, which is most of them, are on their map. So you can go and find lace guilds all over the place. And you'd be surprised, most lace guilds are not in metro areas, but tend to be like just outside of them or even in more rural areas. So don't think that because you're not in a big city, you can't find lace. In fact, I had a hard time finding it in the city, although I do now have my own lace guild, Brooklyn Lace Guild.
Yes.
Globally, it depends. I know lace teachers in Taipei who I've connected people with. I know lace teachers in South Africa. I mean, they're really all over the place. But I think as a start, OIDFA is the European and more international lace organization. And if you reach out to them, it's also the International Organization of Lace, but it's French. Don't make me pronounce French on this. I'm sorry.
No, never.
But OIDFA, OIDFA. Okay, good.
Okay, I will link to
and
that.
They also have a website. Yes.
Okay.
So you can find, they have great connections. Their next, actually, sadly, their Congress, they have a Congress every 2 years in different countries. They've had them in Australia and Japan, but normally they're in Europe because that's where the biggest ACE is. But this year's was supposed to be in Estonia, which I was so hyped for. I'm dying to go to Estonia, but unfortunately, you know, it's been postponed, which is wise.
Yeah.
So it'll be next year. But the 2021 Estonia conference, I'm so excited about. So, but, you know, I would say once you get connected to a lace maker, they tend to be human Rolodexes that can connect you to other lace makers. So if you really can't find someone in your area, there are teachers that teach online. And you can also reach out to me at Brooklyn Lace Guild, and I'll let you know if I know someone around you. I've been recently connecting with some lace makers in South America and Central America. So they're all over the place.
Thanks, Elena. That's so nice. And I will put links to all of those things that you mentioned in the So What social media stuff so people can get all up in their lace making skills and connect and network and learn. Thank you. What is your favorite kind of lace and why?
Ooh, that's a good question. And it's difficult because there are so many kinds of lace that I love, obviously. I think as far as needle lace goes, many lace makers' great love is Growpoint or Golpon de Venise needle lace, which is a Venetian needle lace that flourished predominantly in the 17th century, but there's a lot of replication efforts and reproduction efforts in the late 19th century. So there are some sneaky pieces that look like they're 17th century, but are actually much newer, which is a whole nother issue. But that is kind of this very Baroque, very ornate, three-dimensional needle lace that was, I think, made a lot in Venetian convents. You know, these ladies have a lot of time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
they're the only ones who have time to spend, you know, thousands of hours on a single collar that could take a year. You know, it's really time-consuming, and you should look it up because it doesn't look like what we today think of as lace, because it's not this flat, sheer, tool grounded kind of frothy thing. It's this very heavy three-dimensional lace that's exquisite. And lace historian Pat Earnshaw did this analysis of Growpoint where she found that it could have like 6,000 stitches per square inch. It looks like carved ivory because it's so densely worked. Like, it doesn't look like, you can't see the stitches really.
Like, I'm looking at photos of this right now, and it looks almost modern because I truly don't think my brain can understand that hands made that.
Yeah, I don't think I can either, actually. There are pieces of lace that just hurt my feelings because I can't comprehend how a human being made them. I mean, it is just unreal. And the kind of things that I make is like child's play in comparison, which is okay because it's not my job to make lace every day. Thank goodness.
For people who are not lace pros, and like I've read the Santina Levy lace book, and even I am like, oh, there's a lot of lace ground to cover, and it's impossible to like know it all unless you are a lace princess like yourself. So could you tell me a bit more about like the history of lace making, the kinds that were made, and kind of how it seems to have kind of made its way around the world. There are so many different regional lace forms. I'm really curious about how all of that happened, if that's something that you could speak to.
Absolutely. And I will say Santina Levy, for being as incredibly rich as it is really just a Western European history. So it doesn't even get into Eastern Europe or Russia or like the whole rest of the world. So don't feel like you don't know a lot, because I feel like I don't know a lot. And in fact, the more I learn, I feel like I realize that I know even less than I think I know, which is good. I mean,
yeah,
a good historian should always be learning forever.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's always more to, and there's so many unknowns in the history of lace. So it's hard to, you know, to give this, you know, it started in this year, in this time, in this place, but that's, you're used to that. So, what's interesting about lace is that unlike other textile techniques, like, weaving, for example, it's really an umbrella term for a huge variety of techniques that don't necessarily have something in common, like it's constructed on some type of loom. So needle lace and bobbin lace are structurally totally different, and not to mention tatting or lace crochet or, you know, hairpin lace or sprang or all these other peripherally related lace techniques. There's endless ones that, like, I could go on for the whole episode and not cover all of them. But that's what makes it so interesting, is that it's such a difficult thing to define lace. You can't define it by fiber because it can be made kind of out of anything. But it's sort of the loose category is that it's like a structural open work techniques, where the pattern is defined by the voided areas that are made using some sort of thread or filament like wire or hair. So that's sort of the general category, but there's so many things that could fit in that, but that does exclude like laser cutting. To jump back to the historical portion, because lace was so widespread over Western Europe, there are a number of countries that dispute that they were the originators of it. I would say the top two contenders are Italy and Belgium, and they both have records really early, like in the late 15th century, that indicate potential lace being made. One is in Milan in 1493. The Sforza sisters' inventory mentions lace in their clothing inventory, although Santina Levy disputes this, so, you know, questionable, whatever. Etymology is really difficult with early lace because it wasn't a category yet. It was just, you know, it was still developing, so people didn't consistently call it the same thing. So, like, in Queen Elizabeth's wardrobe, she has lace that is the lace we're discussing, and then she has lace that are like, you know, corset laces or shoe laces, because those are also lace. And the reason that that's the same name is because shoelaces have a braided structure that is similar to the origin of bobbin lace structure, which is braided.
Get out of here. That's crazy. Yeah.
So bobbin lace essentially developed out of braiding techniques that just got so elaborate that they couldn't keep track of the threads anymore. You know, think of macrame with all the threads hanging off, although macrame is a knotted technique and bobbin lace is not knotted. There are no knots in it. In fact, if a good lace maker tries to avoid knots except for like in finishing techniques and that sort of thing. But it's really crossing and twisting in braided, complex braided structures. So somebody either in Belgium or in Italy in the late 15th or early 16th century decided we're going to attach these wooden dowels or bobbins to the threads to keep them organized because this is becoming too complicated. And you're crossing and twisting them in pairs to create the pattern. Whereas needle lace, which developed simultaneously, basically, most likely in Italy, developed out of embroidery techniques. So specifically cut work and drawn work embroidery techniques where, you know, you start with the base, plain weave linen fabric base, and then you trace your pattern onto it. You cut and draw out threads from within the pattern areas to create a voided design, and then you work buttonhole stitches back into them to finish the edges and to do more elaborate fillings and that sort of thing. But as you know, plain weave linen fabric in the 15th and 16th century was incredibly labor intensive to produce. It wasn't like the $3 a yard muslin that we buy now. Somebody had to grow the flax and red it and process it and spin it and hand weave it and all this stuff. So to throw out all this thread was really wasteful. So somebody, again, innovated and said, you know what, let's just do away with the base fabric and we'll work directly onto the pattern. So in order to do that, they have parchment, a parchment pattern base, with the drawing of the design on it. And then you couch outline threads around the major motif areas. So like the larger motif areas, you lay down threads around the outline and tack them down through the base. Mm-hmm. And then you're able to work stitches back into those couched threads without penetrating the base. So
crazy.
And they're buttonhole stitches, variations on buttonhole stitches with multiple twists and all kinds of things. They get very complicated. But that, in Italian, there's a technique called punto in aria, or stitches in air, which is a really good definition of that, because you're really just stitching into the air, back into the couch threads. And then when you're finished with your piece, you can turn it over and you just have to clip the couch threads, the couching threads off, and then you can remove your lace. So it, although aesthetically it's related to bobbin lace, and they in fact imitated each other depending on what was in fashion, and they can be really hard to tell apart without magnification sometimes, but they are actually structurally completely unrelated. So that's a crazy thing about
it. That is so wild.
Yeah. And then globally, there are traditions. Netting is something that goes back to ancient Egypt, and you saw it in ancient Peru. And, you know, it's throughout the world. That is a different technique where you're actually making knots around like a little, almost like a little bone folder thing, if you've seen one of those before. So that's even a different technique. And then you can do like fillet stitches back into those mesh squares to create patterns. So that has an older history that is not European. It's more global. But, you know, lace making spread really fast, starting in the 16th century when pattern books started to be more widespread and available. The first bobbin lace pattern book was La Pompe in 1557, which La Pompe Opera Nova, which was published in Venice. And this circulated all over the place. And we have patterns, we have pieces in Ratti that can be clearly identified as coming from La Pompe. So then you see it pops up everywhere, like immediately, like as soon as lace is a thing, it's everywhere. It's all over Eastern Europe. And then of course, when Spanish and Portuguese and French colonize other nations, they take it with them. And so now we have lace traditions in all over the place, in South America, in Paraguay, in Peru, in Brazil, And in Sri Lanka, there's a bobbin lace tradition. So it's become really its own global thing.
I am obsessed.
Me too.
I know the basics of lace, especially when lace making is present on like 17th century samplers. But I never really even understood the basics of how, especially needle lace, was made. Like, I just couldn't understand what was going on. So I thank you, because I've just learned so much.
It's hard to understand. It really is. And this is why, just jumping forward in my thought process, but like, this is why for me, as an historian and as someone who's a lace scholar and maker, I feel like embodied knowledge of making is so important, you know. People have looked down on it for so long within academia, and now it's finally getting its due a little bit, but it's invaluable to me. I just could not possibly understand lace the way that I do. And I think this is especially true for textiles and lace. Certain techniques may be less complicated to understand that don't necessitate this. Nobody needs to learn how to paint in order to study the history of painting, because we all understand how paintings are made. Yeah. But I'm sure it would benefit you, of course. But for textiles in particular, there's such a big learning curve that I think learning to make things is super helpful, and not to necessarily be good at it or be a maker, but just to try.
I definitely agree. I think it tells you so much, not only about how things were made, but specifically like, how did you have to sit? What kind of lighting conditions did you have to be under? How did you choose your thread colors, and why did you choose your thread colors? Or, you know, what kind of chair do you have to sit in to make your lace, and what materials were used? I mean, there are so many different questions that I think academia alone cannot get to. No offense to academia. Love you. You know, big fan. But I do think that it is necessary with textiles to mix making and studying, because I think they benefit each other so much, and you get a really incomplete idea of what a textile is and does and how it's made and how it works with its maker and how the maker works with it if you don't do both.
For me, it was working on this project for a while that took my time for several months, every day working on this lace project and sitting at my lace pillow for like 10 hours a day. Like the aches that I felt. And I have electric lighting, you know, and I have air conditioning and I have, you know, I live in a totally different world. And yet my body was so achy at the end of the day. I was like, wow, I can't imagine doing this for 12 or 15 hours a day for your whole life with maybe Sundays off. You know, it really changes your perspective on how people in history lived. Because lace makers are not usually even mentioned in texts about lace history. There's so few records about their lives that it's kind of impossible to write about them because they were purposefully written out of the conversation. So what we have is these incredible objects, lace objects, and we have incredible portraits of people wearing lace, namely the aristocracy. And then we have records of royal inventories and that sort of thing. But the maker gets sort of left out of the story tragically. And so I think this embodied knowledge of making is one way that we can reconnect with the makers behind these things to understand them better.
I think that's entirely true. I think one of the reasons I am doing this podcast, in addition to just being deeply obsessed with, you know, textiles and needlework generally, is I've always been, I think one of the reasons I like history is because I like stories and I like people.
Yes.
And I think there is inevitably so many of the makers of textiles have been written out of the narrative that I do think that talking about them, thinking about them, even if we don't know who they are specifically, to understand how they lived their days through the objects they made and learning how to make the objects that they did as well, is a really good way of, and maybe one of the only ways of getting to who they were and getting to know them beyond the bits of their objects that survive.
Absolutely. And this is, you know, this is really getting to the heart of what I was talking about earlier with Tessie Schoenholzer, the lace historian, telling me the lace tells a story. You know, it's not that you literally know what the lace maker was feeling. And by looking at a textile, we can't make that argument seriously. Yeah. But we can definitely look at them and take something away about the lace maker or the maker of textiles or objects generally about their lives and the quality of life. And often like 16 lace makers would share a single candle and like just wild things like that. And in England, there's a holiday. It's more than just in England, but it's still celebrated often in England. Candlemas, which is November 25th, which is the day that you're allowed to start using candles as a lace maker. You're not allowed to use them all summer. And then in February, there's like another holiday where then you're not allowed to use them anymore. They had these ingenious devices that were these like glass globes filled with water that were like magnifiers of light that you could put next to the candle and it would direct a tiny beam of light like right at your pillow. But, you know, when people say things like, oh, lace makers went blind and all this stuff, actually, what I think that I've learned from all of that information that I just shared, and also from my experience making lace, is that it is such an embodied knowledge of your hands that oftentimes you're in a scenario where you can't see, or it's difficult to see, and your hands have to know what they're doing. For me, when I'm working, I'll make a mistake, and my hands know it before my brain, before my brain and my eyes do. I'll feel that I was like, ooh, that's wrong. And then I'll look down and go, yep, that was wrong, and I can undo it. But they didn't have diagrams and patterns to follow the way that we do now as lace makers. So the knowledge that they had to execute these really elaborate designs, they just had to know what they were doing. It was all in their heads and in their hands. So it really changes the level of skill that you would have to have. Like, it's just mind-boggling. It's incredible. I can't fathom it. I will say I'm not the first person to arrive at these ideas, and I'm not the first person to make these arguments. So I'm not, you know, positing myself as like the first to arrive here. For sure, there have been many before me that have had these experiences with making and scholars of lace and of other textiles conservators and scholars and, you know, wonderful people out there. So I give full credit to my predecessors for all that I have learned.
Heck yeah. But I think, so thank you. That is really helpful. I think you're also a really, you're a really good and knowledgeable and interesting voice in the conversation. And it's a pleasure and an honor to hear you speak about it. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. That's so kind. That's nice to hear.
Okay, so you are out here living my dream as the collection specialist at the Rotti Center. And as a collection specialist, you probably see more historic needlework than like 99.9999% of the population. So what are the best, coolest, weirdest things that have that you've seen during your time at Rotti?
I shouldn't have a favorite piece of lace because it feels unfair to all the other beautiful and wonderful and magical pieces of lace that exist in the world that I also love. But I kind of do, which is this 5 foot long, 13 panel, like 17th century Italian Punto in Aria needle lace telling the story of Judith and Holofernes.
Yes.
It's like a comic strip. It's incredible. We really don't know exactly what it was for. It would certainly not have been worn and probably not ecclesiastical, but like not sure where this would have been maybe displayed in the home or something like that. It's so unusual. It's exquisite. It's beautifully well done. It's an incredible example of Punto in Aria needle lace, which is the first kind of form of often figural needle laces after it had developed out of reticella like cutwork lace. Mm-hmm. So it is very early and it's early figural. And it's so detailed. I mean, everyone's outfits have like slashing in the sleeves and, you know, you see the scene with Judith holding Holofernes' head and the sword and there's like lace blood drops coming off his head. I mean, it's just, it's exquisite. And actually, there are other pieces of lace in other collections, like the Cooper Hewitt, that tell the story of Judith and Holofernes. So I think these sort of not necessarily canonical, I forget the word, Old Testament stories were very popular. And like they were in embroidery at the same time.
Yeah, all over the place.
There's also this collar, similarly, it's figural. I'm definitely drawn to figural laces. But this is identified as Ragusa lace, which is a type of needle lace that kind of looks like filet crochet or English holly point, if you're familiar with that type of needle lace. That was made in Croatia, neighboring Venice at the time. So the areas around Venice, like Slovenia and Croatia, also have very early lace histories because they're so close. And so it uses also techniques of Venetian grow point. So it has like raised areas, but it's this little collar. Heartbreakingly, a Victorian 19th century person chopped it up and made it into like a little Peter Pan shaped collar. So it's no longer in the original structure. This is classic lace history. Oh my gosh. The Victorians loved it so much. They bought all the 17th century lace and cut it up and made it into other things, which breaks my heart. But, you know, now it's part of the history of those objects. So that's true.
That's another chapter in their story.
It's another chapter in their story. This piece has Leda and the Swan, it has the Rape of Europa, it has Judith and Holofernes, it has Cupid and Venus, it has all these little vignettes of beautiful figures in the Ragusa style needle lace surrounded with the grow point three-dimensional lace, and it's just so epically fabulous. And I think my third, I won't say that this is in order necessarily, but that it's...
Love all of your children equally.
I love all my children equally, but maybe this is a list in order, although it's subject to change at any time. There is a human hair Chantilly lace fan. That I love. That's really fun to touch because it's so weird and scratchy and it feels nothing like silk Chantilly lace. Mm-hmm. Not that I like touch it frequently, but you know, when you move it, it like scrapes the paper. It like makes a sound because it's human hair and it's plied together too. So somebody went through the work of taking individual strands of hair and plying them together to make this Chantilly lace fan. It's just absolutely exquisite and clearly, you know, a novelty thing. It's unusual. You don't see it At that time period, most hair work was what we know of as, like, you know, Victorian hair work, which is like table braiding, and which is related to bob and lace, but it's not the same category.
What are the unexpected things that you've come across in Rati?
Oh my gosh, that is such a good question. You know, the thing that's kind of challenging is that I actually haven't been there in a number of months. So I do yearn to return. I hope to return as soon as possible. But gosh, there are so many really cool and interesting things. Definitely the 17th century raised work embroidery caskets and that sort of thing are some of my favorite. They're just absolutely breathtaking and phenomenal. And, you know, anyone who sees them is completely blown away by them.
Heck yeah.
I will also say that, like, the American Textiles collection is something that I knew less about. And I have learned so much from my lovely boss, Amelia Peck. So wonderful, so knowledgeable, and so generous with her knowledge. So the American Textiles collection has been really incredible to learn about, in particular, the objects made by young women with really interesting provenance that talks about girls' education, quilts with all different, you know, topics. There's like a suffrage quilt that we have that's really fascinating, that's all appliqué, that talks about, like, women's right to vote, although I will say I believe it's unclear whether it's for or against suffrage.
Some ambiguity. All right.
I will also say that although we are a textiles department, we do store some costume or dress items as well, and that's really interesting as well. So, like, the dragon robes from the Asian art department from China are with the absolutely breathtaking, incredible embroidery, and there's actually one in particular that is velvet from the 18th century woven to shape using spun peacock feathers. That is just, and it's polychrome velvet, so they're, like, changing warp and weft colors all over the place, like this. Oh my gosh, that one just makes me cry. I can't even understand it. Speaking of velvet, the Persian Safavid velvets from now Iran with different wefts changing color that have, like, literal figures outlined in fine lines around them are just, those just blow my mind. I mean, beyond. Those are just absolutely breathtaking. Really, I've learned so much at Rati. I can't emphasize how much of an incredible experience it has been and how much I miss it and want to go back soon.
What do you think the role of needlework is in today's world? That's a big question.
Yeah, it's such a great question. It's such an important question, and it's something that I think about often. Obviously, we live in a very rapidly advancing, technological, digitally focused world, especially in a coronavirus world where many of us in our homes and you know, the internet and social media are some of the only ways that we have to connect with other people. And so digital technology is super important, and I don't negate the value of that, but I think simultaneously, in order to exist in this world and keep a sense of our own humanity, I think it's really important to learn to do things with your hands, whether they're with a needle and thread or with bobbins or with carving tools or a potter's wheel or whatever you enjoy. But I think working with your hand is it's such an important way to ground yourself and connect yourself to the earth and to history. Mm-hmm. For me, when I make lace, not only is it the only way that I can sort of clear my mind and have a meditative practice, when I normally am running around like crazy and have all these things that I'm doing and I can't clear my head for 1 second. So not only does it give me the space where I can just sort of exist, it can be, you know, a way to process the world. But additionally, it connects me to lace makers throughout history. You know, I really feel connected to them in my hands doing the same motions that theirs did for 500 years. And, you know, as I said, I think it's so fantastic that embodied knowledge is finally getting more recognition as a valid form of research. And understanding within academia, which is long overdue. So, and I also think that it's kind of a radical act today to make something for yourself to enjoy without a commercial end use. It's an act of defiance in a capitalist society that wants you to monetize everything that you're doing and do everything in this very public and performative way. And while I do sometimes, or have sometimes sold things that I've made, you know, I no longer really feel the need to do that in lace making. It is just impossible. It is too time consuming. Although there are a few designers who incorporate bobbin lace into their work, you know, just as a maker personally, if I've even considering like a little strip of lace for a choker that I made by hand would be 20 hours of work potentially. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I'm just making it for my own pleasure. And I think that that is so valuable and important to have something that is just for you in that way.
I do have one last question for you, which is how do we learn more about your work? Is there anything that you want to promote? How do we get to know more about you and your lace making and your lace scholarship?
Great question. So I don't really have any of my own personal work to promote at the moment, but I would love to give a shout out to the Met Rati Textile Center Instagram account, which I run with my fabulous colleagues in department and with the support of curatorial and conservation staff to write about textiles in our collection, which has been especially important during the museum's closure. So please go give us a follow on Instagram. And then also, I am the co-founder of Brooklyn Lace Guild, which is a lace organization based in Brooklyn, of course. So I began Brooklyn Lace Guild with a couple of friends in 2016 because there was no lace organization in the metro area at that point, or in New York City. There is one in the metro area in New Jersey, and there's several others in New Jersey and upstate New York, but not in New York City. But what I didn't realize at the time is that it was actually 100 years to the anniversary of the founding of the Needle and Bobbin Club, which was the first lace guild in New York City, which met at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So really, it makes me feel, again, connected to history in this really important way. But so we have a website, brooklynlaceguild.com. We also have social media. It's all Brooklyn Lace Guild. Yeah, we do online events, or at least we're working on them right now. Typically, they would be in person, but that's the beauty, I guess, of the shutdown is that now we're able to make our content more accessible. So give us a follow and Rati, and stay tuned for future events and things that you might be able to access from anywhere in the world.
Yes, amazing. Thank you so much. Genuinely, this was such a joy, such a pleasure, and such an honor. You speak very beautifully and wonderfully and so eloquently about things that I think about a lot. And you taught me a lot of stuff, including some like really crazy fun facts. So thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a treat and a pleasure to talk and catch up. And I love sharing my love of lace more than just about anything else. So the pleasure's all mine.
So that was my interview with Elena. Isn't she a gem? That was such a fun, informative time. I learned so much, and I hope you did too. I feel really lucky that I get to interview such cool people for this podcast. Truly, what a delight. As always, thanks for listening, and thanks for being really nice, supportive listeners. You are all such wonderful people. Thank you. Now go out and stitch some stories, maybe out of bobbin lace or needle lace. Bye!